Welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast, everybody. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with my podcasting partner, Peter Rollins. And this is a podcast where we look at different aspects of life, and we try to look at it in unique, fun, helpful ways. Sometimes we talk about things like Stoicism or mysticism or occasionally Lacanian psychoanalysis on the off day or off weeks. And on this particular episode, we're going to be talking about the idea of illness because I myself am not feeling well and I haven't been feeling well for about a week and a half, 2 weeks now, and that's never fun. Nothing terrible, just enough to kind of slow me down a little bit. And so we're going to do the order of service. The first thing we do on this podcast is we do some announcements up top. That way you hear them. And the first announcement is that if you haven't heard already, Pete and I are doing our first ever live Fundamentalists podcast at Central Avenue Church in Glendale, California on August 29th at 8 p.m. You can get tickets in the description of this podcast. You can get tickets at peterrollins.com. And there is free booze. There's free alcohol. Speaking of free alcohol, if you would like to be at the live show, but you can't make it because you live somewhere else, well, first of all, thank you for listening to this. And if you would like to take part in spirit, you can go to trywink.com/thefundamentalists. That's T-R-Y-W-I-N-C because the company is called Wink and they're a wine company, and you can take this little palate quiz that will tell you exactly what kind of wines you like according to the foods that you eat, and they'll recommend all sorts of stuff, and it's really cool bottles. And we have a whole case coming for this event, which is going to be really exciting, even though we're going to keep a couple of the bottles.
I would say a few of them will probably not find their way to the event.
Yeah. In fact, I would venture to say a few of them will find their way to the event, and that will be the extent of it. So anyway, really good wine, all sorts of it, so check it out. Helps us help support the podcast, and it's also $25 off, which is like about two bottles of wine. It's a little under two bottles of wine for free. And it's really good wine. So anyway, we're talking about being under the weather. We're talking about illness, physical illness, and what's going on internally and externally when you're sick, I'm assuming. I'm very excited about this subject. The other subject we were going to talk about was macabre. Yeah. Somebody suggested that, which I think is really cool. Someone slid into my DMs, and it's so funny when, you know, what comes up in social media direct messages, you know, because it's either going to be like the most lewd, like almost like visual assault on me, or it's going to be like, hey, I'd love to hear you, you know, discuss the idea of the macabre. But basically, I did an Instagram story where I was like at work. Our editor, one of our editors was like, she saw a dead flat squirrel out in the alley, and she's like, we got to go see it. And of course, and everyone,
I saw the little Instagram story where you were going out to see it.
It was baffling. I've never seen that group of people who I love very much come together so quickly over something so like, do you guys realize why are we running out to see this dead thing? And that made somebody go like, I want to hear Pete talk about the idea, the fascination with the macabre, which we'll get to probably closer to Halloween though. I feel like that's
maybe we can keep that in our back pockets. We almost did it today. And then the illness one just felt more appropriate.
More relevant. So anyway, I'm not feeling great, and I don't take care of myself when I get super sick. I'm not great at it. At least I haven't been lately. I'm getting a little better at it as of late. But the way this normally works is I'm like, hey, here's what's going on. And I offer a subjective experience, and then Pete comes in and offers something that tends to be a little bit more substantial, and that's going to happen in four.
Okay. All right. Nice.
You're on. Like
I'm on.
Well, I felt myself get so worn out.
Is that it?
I shut down.
Do you want to go? Do you want to have we?
Yeah, I'm actually going to do my thing. Room. Yeah. I'm exhausted. You can finish it up.
You've been, you know, working hard, doing a lot.
So
you're
sweet.
Run down.
Do you really feel I've been working hard?
Yeah.
That's very sweet
of you. Absolutely,
because I'm having so much fun. We've talked.
You are so enjoying
it's the time of our lives.
Yeah.
Pete.
Oh, it is, man. Well, I thought I would start with the kind of probably the most famous quote of Nietzsche, like the one that almost everybody knows.
I think, therefore, I am.
Yes. Yeah, that famous
live, laugh, love.
Yes, wrecking ball. What were they?
Coexist.
Yeah. it is what doesn't kill you makes you strong.
Okay,
right. We all know it. We've heard it, and of course, when you hear it, you go, "It's obviously wrong."
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about this because you were sick, and I thought, okay, this would be a good chance to look at this quote. You think about it. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, of course, that's wrong because you get cancer, you survive it. But it doesn't make you stronger.
Yeah, you're not like a superhuman after that.
Yeah, you're probably in bed for a long, long time. Or if you're psychologically dealing with something and that really weakens you, you don't come out the other end stronger. You know, it can stop you going out. It can make you have to wash your hands 100 times. Like, it'll do what a whole pile of
wreak havoc on you.
Yes. You know, you break up with somebody and it doesn't kill you, but it doesn't mean it makes you stronger. Again, you might just want to hide for a year. But in its wider context, Nietzsche's saying something I think that's actually very, very profound. Because in its context, what he's saying is he is basically saying that some people are so sick that even healthy things become sick. And there are some people that are so healthy that even when they're ill, they can even turn their illness into something healthy. So you think about somebody who, you know, they're physically healthy, they're getting on with life, they're young, but everything they see is negative. Everything they say just brings things down. Everything is attacking, everything is sickly, everything. You know, you can't enjoy something that is good. It has to be taken down.
Right.
So Nietzsche is saying that that is a type of health that is actually sickly. And he, for him, that destroys society, that destroys individuals, it destroys the world. Whenever people affirm sickness and always attack healthy things and good things.
Yeah, okay.
And then on the other side, there are people who maybe are physically ill, they're dealing with something, and yet they are able to affirm life, and they're able to take their sickness and kind of affirm life in the midst of it. And he's probably thinking about himself, because Nietzsche was a very sick person. He suffered from ill health all his life. And
what did he have? Do you know what he had?
You know, I don't know exactly. I mean, he eventually lost his mind.
One of those old-timey diseases?
Yeah. Well, some people think at the end of his life he had syphilis, and that drove him mad.
Yeah.
His madness is fascinating, but because it happened on the dawn of the 20th century, and supposedly he was walking down this street, and he saw this horse getting beaten. And he ran up to the horse, he kissed the horse, and was never seen again.
That's the end of Nietzsche?
That was the end of Nietzsche. Then he spent the last, you know, 10 years in a mental asylum, claiming he was Christ and the crucified one and whatnot.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea about any of this. Oh, yeah, I've never heard of any of this.
And what's interesting is Dostoevsky's book, Crime and Punishment, has the character Raskolnikov. One of the scenes in the book is Raskolnikov is walking down the street, sees a horse getting beaten, and goes up and embraces and kisses the horse. And I've been a long time since I read the book, but you know, I think that's a symbol of Raskolnikov kind of like breaking down in madness. So there's this, and Dostoevsky was a fan of, or sorry, Nietzsche was a fan of Dostoevsky. So there's a very poetic dimension.
Oh, so the book was written prior to Nietzsche kissing the horse.
Yes, I think, that would be the case, and Nietzsche would have read the book, but yeah.
And then in that moment saw a horse getting beaten after reading this book. Huh.
Bam, and he was gone.
Well, I got more questions than I do. I got so many questions about that, but that's not what we're talking
about. That's not what we're talking about.
So many questions.
And of course, Nietzsche.
What did the horse say? Are they still together?
Was the horse
did
okay?
It work out?
Yeah. You know. And he also wrote, you know, you wrote about the madman who ran into the marketplace telling everyone that God was dead. So, you know, there's a foreshadowing there of Nietzsche's madness. So there's a fascinating stuff.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. But that's not, the thing. Oh, yeah, but he, before the syphilis, and they don't know if it was syphilis, but he had just always had health issues. He was an absolute genius, but he had to leave university life because he was always sick. He had to go into places where there was very pure air, all of that kind of stuff. And so what he wanted to accomplish is he was basically trying to find a way of affirming life even in the midst of his sickness and his illness. And in a way, that's what Nietzsche was trying to do in general, saying like life is difficult and painful, can drag us down. Is there a way of overcoming nihilism? Is there a way of saying yes to existence even in the midst of, you know, physical and psychological illness?
And that's what he meant. And you're saying that's what he meant by what doesn't kill you makes you sick.
Yeah, because he's talking about a certain type of person. For the healthy person, mm-hmm. what doesn't kill them makes them stronger. But then for the unhealthy person, the sick, mentally sick or physically sick, but the person who lets sickness into their psyche, I would say, then it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Whatever is strong, they will make weak.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, and one final thing on that is that Nietzsche then had a thought experiment that he wrote about how, you know, basically this is Nietzsche's salvation, right? He says, imagine that a demon, an evil demon comes to your room and says that you're going to have to go through everything in your life again and again and again for all of eternity. So everything you have experienced, all the sickness, the illness, the pains, the joys, the breakups, the makeups, everything, you will for all eternity live in every moment. He says, well, what is your response?
I'd be
You're like, yeah, like, whatever.
Like, that's worst case scenario?
Can I go back to sleep?
Okay, yeah, all right. See
could,
you in
could
a few
we do
years?
This in the morning?
Yeah, I'll see you in a lifetime. I guess I'll, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's pretty good, because Nietzsche would say that is you not despairing over that thought.
Well, what's the alternative? That you just die?
Well, no, the alternative would be when you hear the demon say that, you might go, shit, that's, I don't want to do that. And despair.
Oh, no, I don't have that. But I mean, also, I've had a, you know, had a pretty good life. So I feel like that, but is that, that's not what you're talking about. You're not talking about a good life, because anybody has had a good life. It's the perspective that that person has. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but you know, but maybe it would be easier for somebody to say, oh, yes to that, I guess, if they've had a better life.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But everybody, you know, you can't escape like the trauma that is life itself.
Like, even if you have a good life. Yeah. Exactly. Like I can, this is an interesting, like the, it's such a weird thing because my mom, I was talking to my mom at some point about something, and she was, we were talking about stuff with the past, and she was like, well, she's like, you know, you went through a period where you probably were like having some kind of low level depression and you weren't talking about it, et cetera, et cetera. And she was like, you know, it's just a matter of like, not, you know, not, you have to look on the bright side. Like sometimes in life, you like life can give, throws you all sorts of things, and you look on the bright side. And I was like, you know, it's interesting, because I think I sometimes suffer from the opposite, where I look on the bright side to, as a, like to a fault, where it's like, oh, this is fine, this is fine, like this will take care of itself, this is good, life is good. You know, when the company is scary and terrifying, that's fine, everything's fine. And I'm painting everything in these constant, like, you know, rose colors or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that like, it's almost like there's also a version of unhealth, I think, that is the extreme of what Nietzsche is saying is the good thing.
Well, that's true. And Nietzsche was very critical of that. He hated that. He was a straight edge guy. So he did no alcohol, drugs or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And his big thing was he felt that religion and alcohol were basically the same thing. They're both drugs that help to take away from looking at reality.
Yeah.
Face on. So for him, Sunday morning church or Saturday night drunkenness, they're both decadent realities. In fact, he said once, he said, you know, when a drunk person falls, you know, they get up, dust themselves down. But he says, beware of us who are made of glass. When we fall, we smash. And he's talking about, in a sense, people who are able to kind of live without going into optimism, like as we, which we all do, either optimism and oh, it's all going to be okay, or pessimism, oh, it's not going to be okay, but somehow transcend both of those and simply embrace and affirm existence without either like drunkenness to get us through, and he means the drunkenness of, say, religion, the drunkenness of like opiates or whatever.
The truth, finding like whatever the actual reality of the world is and dealing it with it in that way. Very difficult. Like, and it's weird to be in a situation where it's more difficult, because the easier option is, if you fall into optimism, the easier option is to fall into optimism. Like pessimism, I'm sure it's great for people who are pessimists, and that sounds, well, it sounds terrible to be honest, but like if the situation I'm in of like, oh, my tipping point, it tips me toward a delusional state of basically ignorance, like happy ignorance. I mean, that's a lovely place to be. Yeah. I really like it. I enjoy it a lot.
You know, that, I think that is, I was talking to a friend about this the other day. I think that view is in the great American novel. So you take something like The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby ends with a guy who's looking out across the water to his beloved. And there's a green light at the that he can see from, that's basically, I think it's a light that's at the edge of her house. And he's looking out at that and he's killed. And so he dies in optimistic hope for the future for this woman who is there just out of reach. And so there's this, it's an incredible book, but it's it raises the question of what is the best way to live. So is he heroic that he's dying with this ultimately illusional hope, like this woman who would never live up to the possibility, etc. But he's, that's what gets him through. This optimism allows him to infirm life, or should he have just, you know, forgotten her and moved on? Or is there a third option? And I think Nietzsche is trying to say there's another way, that is not that we get through life through having kind of illusions, but neither do we get into some sort of Schopenhauerian pessimism where life is just, you know, nothing.
That Great Gatsby thing reminds me of, and I'm sure I'm reaching back like 20 years, but not 20 years, good God, I'm not that old, 15 years, to high school when there was like a class on Death of a Salesman, and it was about how Willie Loman, the protagonist in Death of a Salesman, whether he was a tragic hero because he, and I could be completely misremembering everything about this, so sorry folks if I'm wrong, but like he basically kills himself in an effort to get insurance money for his family. So he does not, he's a salesman. Well, I mean, I guess he does do that because it's called Death of a Salesman. So he's not making money, he kills himself, but the money never comes through. So the family never gets financial security. Yeah. And so the question is like, you know, it's this beautiful play and what a hero he was. And then the conversation is like, well, was it better for him to die and then his family get nothing? But he dies in this belief that it will.
Yeah. You know,
so it's like he's dying, not like, I'm not saying it's the same thing, but the Great Gatsby guy is dying in the hope of like, oh, this is gonna happen, you know. And then this guy he knows his death is coming, but he still thinks that like that thing is, he's still gonna obtain it. By dying, his family will be set free. But then when they're not, it's like, oh, that's a very tragic.
And does he do it? Do they know that he does it for that reason?
That I don't know. I don't remember.
Because Zizek talks about this, but it's like, if you're going to, you know, die or kill yourself for someone you love, should you let them know? So the idea is like, you know, if you're in a plane and the plane is going to crash, do you phone up your loved one and say, I love you, I've always loved you, I'll always, you know, I'll never forget you, you're with me in these last moments, right?
Yeah.
And you go, because this is what most people do, but that's awful. Because then
it's not
that
awful.
Is awful. Because no, how are they going to get over you? Like I remember I read about
exactly.
I read about some story where this guy died of cancer, and what he'd done is he'd prepaid this florists to send flowers to his wife for every year at Valentine's Day for like the next 20 years, whatever, for life.
I mean, that's a psychotic thing. Yeah. To do.
Well, people loved it. Like it went around Facebook and all that. People loved it, and I was like, what a bastard.
Oh no, that's
like
so
that's,
bad.
That's like, how does she move on from this? As like, is this the most beautiful thing? What you should do is, and this is what Zizek says in front, is you phone up and you go, I never loved you, don't like you, I had a big massive affair with your best friend, screw you, put it in front. But the reason why it's so difficult to do is because
it's not true and you love that person.
Well, no, it's because like it's well, especially for a lot of guys, but it is easier to imagine the death of your physical body than the death of your symbolic significance.
Sure.
So you would rather die because some people, I think some women are more prone to this, which is much more impressive, is they're able to kill their symbolic self while living, whereas a guy often won't be able to kill their symbolic idealized image. And you go like, well, what's better? It's very difficult to do, easier to die. So I was just wondering, because if I don't know the play, if he did this and kind of they knew and therefore he becomes a saint and therefore it's very hard for him to move on, or if he did it in such a way that he allowed his symbolic self to die
as well. Yeah. That, wow. What a fun, I'm sure that there's someone who actually knows the play who could actually get to the bottom of that and probably find out that it's in some way, some kind of brilliant play. I actually really enjoyed the play, but I just don't remember. Oh,
by the way, I don't know if this is one that you study in America. It was a play. I've only seen the movie. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah.
Was that that's brilliant. Did David Mamet write that? I actually don't know. I don't know. It was my dad, one of my dad's favorite movies, because he was a seal.
Glenn Ross is really cool. Yeah, that's a cool play. Yeah. I really like Glenn Gary. Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in that. But, you know, but that's just taking us off on a tangent. I just thought, have you seen that?
You're making me miss, like, actual theater, like, plays. Oh, man. That's a different life. I need to go back to do it. I have a friend out here who does a lot of theater, and I'm like, oh man, dude. I'm like, let me know, because I want to.
Well, let's watch that movie maybe in the next few days, because it's a good one.
Alec Baldwin, I think.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I'm so bad with actors.
Young
names.
Alec Baldwin.
There's your man Lemon. Is it Jack Lemmon or something? Mm. Some actor.
Oh, okay. Maybe not Jack.
Because it's way back. It's.
Oh, I might be thinking of a new one. I might be thinking of something totally different. Anyway, getting sick sucks.
So are you able to make your sickness into something positive? I think you are. But I'm going, like, is this Nietzschean thing?
I mean, here's the deal.
Yeah.
If I get sick, it does become a positive thing, because I definitely, I don't know. I just have like that thing that I don't know if it's like, I just become like a kid, and I'm like, there's a very like, just take care of me. I want to be taken care of. And, you know, it tends to work out where I feel very, like, rested. I'm just, like, if I get sick, I feel like people are generally very, like, oh, anything, you know, relax. And it's a nice, the positive of being sick is you can kind of opt out of a lot of the stresses. It definitely gets rid of a lot of the bullshit, because you stop caring if you have to, like, I was waking up on Friday, and I was like, I might actually call in to work, which is, like, an insane, I don't even know who, there's no one to call. So it's, like, yeah. I guess I just tell them I'm not coming, and then I was like, well, I guess I'm gonna do it, because, as you know, I wanted to do it. But like, then I ended up going into work sick, and I was like, well, I get to go into work sick, and I want to go in, because it's so cool right now what's happening. So anyway, I guess it's pretty positive. I don't even care enough to like get medicine. I'm like, eh, it'll get it.
Yeah, although you did come in with a whole pile of medicine the other day.
It was time.
Yeah,
you know,
it was time.
And it was fun to like, it's fun to do a medicine run and be like, yeah, let me try these like homeopathic lozenges. That's fun, because there's so many neat new.
Oh yeah, I don't trust anything that you can't OD on. I mean, I guess that's basically, and those things you could honestly take a truckload of them.
Yeah,
you'd be fine.
Yeah, like, okay. It's just powder and like sugar and honey.
I want something that says if you take one more of these than you're supposed to,
I know,
you and all your family will die.
Yeah,
you know, that's the kind of stuff, right?
That's the that is the only the only thing. Yeah, and then it's like I'm still. You know, I still partake in my recreational activities and do that when I'm sick. And then I just sort of watch TV and relax. It's not bad. It's not a bad world. It just slows me down, and that sucks. And we've all been there. And it's also, by the way, totally not fun to listen to when you're not going through it and somebody starts bitching about not feeling well. It's like, I get it. You don't feel 100%. Don't waste my time with it kind of thing. At least that's how I can get. But I also know that when I am sick, it's just like, we were talking about this a little bit. There's two different realities. If you're sick, you're kind of like, oh, there's no reality in which I won't be sick. And if you're healthy, you're like, I don't know what this guy's talking about. Yeah. I'll never get a cold again.
Yeah. Well, Nietzsche was like, that's another thing. Like, he never talked about how he was sick. He was like, that's the thing. He was sick.
Really?
And he turned it into an affirmation of life. And that's what I think makes his work so interesting. Although he was a little bit, if you read him, he can sound very... Like, he really affirms strength, and it can come across a bit much sometimes, because he's
sort of like that, like woke alpha male kind of, in a way, that kind of way.
Well, he'd be very anti woke, in the sense that I understand that term, but I don't fully understand.
I guess
that term.
Alpha male and like the like strength and like, yeah, I'm a man and I'm gonna stand up, and not when I'm sick, I'm not gonna talk about it, because it's like a stoic thing, like to be a man is to not complain kind of thing.
Yeah, well, for him to be a healthy human, male or female, is to be able to not let sickness, of psychological sickness or physical sickness, take you down, to be able to affirm life. Although he was very sympathetic to how difficult it is, so his whole idea was to try to help people, you know, be able to overcome nihilism, to overcome the tendency to go into depression and illness.
Yeah.
So he was like a proto psychotherapist in a way.
I was when I was doing more into the meditation thing years ago at this point, but I still want to go back to that center. But the lady, you know, they always have those little quotes, the things that make you feel nice when you hear them. But one of them was, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And I think that's a very nice sentiment, because you can be like feeling like crap, but you're not suffering from it because you're engaging with life in a way that's like healthy and fun and different. It's also like, it was like a mindfulness thing. So it's you can isolate the pain and be like, okay, this is pain. You can kind of stop being like, oh, it's pain and I hurt and this ruins everything. And you can kind of be like, this is a shooting pain through my arm and it like hurts, and you're not ignoring it, but you're not attaching everything to it either. Yeah.
And of course, and there's the opposite, which is you can suffer without being in pain, which is the majority of us when you're young.
That's called life. Yeah.
That's called life. Yeah. Is that you can, and that's what Nietzsche was really talking about, I think, is that you can be, even when you're fine, you can give in to bitterness and hatred and the suffering that comes from that negativity.
It's, man, the whole, like, the world, okay, this is whatever, but my bad. Where did that come from? That was like not even. Did you hear that?
I did, but yeah.
Do you have any idea where that came from?
Yeah, I think it's my phone. Oh, it's very.
It sounded like it was in my bedroom. Oh, is that right? Weird. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, life is very beautiful, and it's like, how do you convince people of that? It's like, I don't know what and I don't know if this is what Nietzsche was getting at. And it's also so funny that like having a podcast that like is philosophy and, you know, quote unquote comedy, but like talking about Nietzsche just feels very kind of like. It's almost so on the nose, like talking about him is like, it feels kind of almost cliche, and I don't understand much about him, and I see him constantly quoted in YouTube comments and stuff, but I don't know enough.
He's
about
very
him
quotable because he wrote so much in aphorisms because it was very popular at the time. So he's Human All Too Human, for example, is a book that's basically a big book of aphorisms.
Yeah,
some of them it's a couple of pages long, some of them a paragraph long. Cool. So he's very quotable. He was also an incredible writer. Like, incredible writer.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of his? Like,
Definitely. Cool. I mean, he was, he's one of my early influences, all of that kind of that 19th century time of philosophy was incredible. And Nietzsche is definitely one of the canon. I'm reading him a little bit at the moment, but I haven't read him properly for a long time. But
yeah.
He's very clear as well. You don't have to. Some philosophers are so hard to read. You have to have a PhD to read them.
Hegel.
Hegel, yeah, it's hugely difficult. But Nietzsche is actually very easy to read.
There's a rapper named Milo. I think that's how you pronounce it. There's a song called Folk Metaphysics.
Uh-huh.
And Folk Metaphysics Part 1 or 2. But he's in that. It's like a rap song, and it came on my like Spotify, whatever, and there's a line in it where it's like, why is Hegel so incomprehensible? And like,
no
like
way.
One line, and then I was like, amazing. Dang, I was like, you
that's
never.
The first time Hegel's ever been mentioned in a rap
song,
and, I'm guessing.
When you listen to the rest of the song, you're like, oh, this guy's like on a different level, clearly. But like, it's a very like one of those spoken words, sort of just like very calm. Oh, it's so cool.
Listen to that.
Yeah, he's so cool. Yeah.
Whereas Nietzsche's like all adolescents who read a little bit of philosophy get into Nietzsche, because he's also very. If you're angry, Nietzsche's great. Because Nietzsche is an equal opportunities hater. I mean, he hates everybody. So it's not like you can't single out, oh, he didn't like Christians or something like that. He's like, he didn't like anybody.
Right.
And so if you're a teenager, he's quite fun to get into.
I was talking about that with my dad the other day, because we were talking about the jokes with the Valley folk and kind of writing comedy and like who gets in trouble. You know, it's that classic kind of conversation about political correctness and what's too far. And I was like, it's interesting because we've had people who are Christians be like, I'm not going to watch your stuff anymore because you made fun of like Easter in this way. And I find that offensive. And anytime that happens, I feel the exact same way that I feel if anybody on any side of any political spectrum is like, hey, I'm not going to watch you anymore because like you offended me. I never feel good about it, but it's interesting because it's like, oh, like those are like my Pete. Like I know where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Like if I was where he was, I absolutely wouldn't listen to some of the stuff that we're saying, especially like on the podcast. And it's like, oh, this is what happens. People kind of drop off. But it was like, I was talking to my dad and I was like, we try to make fun of literally, at least I try to make fun of everybody. And if it gets to the point where we're only making fun of sort of the stereotypical right-wing conservative, then I have no interest in that. Cause it makes me want to stab myself in the face. Like I hate it so much. Like that same stupid jokes of like whatever. Anyway, so all that to say, offending everybody is very cool. But I was on Twitter and I was reading a tweet from one of my favorite accounts, which is Existential Comics. I know you only follow one person on on Twitter, which is Joel Osteen, who will not be at our live Fundamentalists, ladies and gentlemen. He canceled last minute.
Yes, we did. We should say now just very quickly what that means.
Okay. Yeah, explain it. I'll let you explain.
Okay. Well, we had a Joel Osteen impersonator who looks the spit of Joel Osteen and actually was able to get on stage at a Joel Osteen event because he looks so like Joel Osteen, who was going to do an opening blessing.
Incredible Vice video.
Check it out. I've seen it. It's very good.
Millions of hits, and it's like he sneaks into a Joel Osteen event and everyone thinks he's Joel Osteen, and it is so funny. And he was on a stand-up show of mine, and so what we were going to do.
Sadly, he had something else he had to do last minute, so that's not happening. Anyway.
But you still follow him on Twitter, so no bridge burn there. Yeah. But anyway, so there's this Twitter account called Existential Comics, and there was a tweet that said, and this just made me think about when you're saying that teens are into Nietzsche, and when you're young, you're into Nietzsche. When you're in your, what was it? Before your 20s, you think no one understands you. In your 20s, you realize you don't understand yourself. And then in your 30s, you realize there's just not that much to understand.
Nice.
And I was like, that's one of those things where it's like, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah,
like when I was before my 20s, I was like, which I'm sure if I was reading Nietzsche, I would be like, oh my God, this is like, absolutely. he totally gets me. It's why like I love Weezer's Pinkerton. And then now I'm 30 and I'm like,
not much to get.
There's this, right.
I can
fine.
Testify to that.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not much going on.
There's not that much depth.
he is that kind of character that you feel like when you're a teenager, nobody gets you.
Nietzsche gets it.
Yeah.
And it's such a cool, it's a cool name. There's something like kind of harsh about the phonetic.
And he was a harsh kind of figure, but incredible, incredible writer.
Yeah. We had this moment, one of the earlier Valley casts that became like, it was like one of those few moments where like I snapped. And I think you either saw it or I told you about it, but like, basically, they were Lee and Steve were saying they didn't want to bring kids into the world or something, and I like just kind of lost it in this very kind of weird way. And I don't know if I was stressed out. I'm sure I was stressed out, but like I basically was like, "No, the world is beautiful. Like we live in a beautiful world, and life is good. Like this is a good time to be alive, despite all the outside stuff that it feels like sometimes." And so, but I was like, "It's interesting that like you can't, you can tell somebody like when Nietzsche is talking about." What's better or worse to be sick or to not feel or to feel it and, or not feel it and make things around you sick. There's no way it seems like to inject people or like brainwash them into that kind of perspective.
Yeah. And by the way, but Nietzsche is very, but he is critical of life is beautiful as well.
Of course.
Like Nietzsche. And in fact, like, but his thing is life is neither beautiful nor awful. Life is just life. So yeah. So Nietzsche felt that,
even when you say that, it feels like a semi truck passing me by.
All right.
Like it doesn't, like I'm just like, yeah, but I can't get on that.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So I guess what he would say is that both life is beautiful and life is awful. This was one of his critiques of Christianity, actually, that it's nihilism. Christianity is nihilism. And what he meant, and let me try and get into my Nietzsche mood, is that the idea that life is incredible and the idea that life is terrible are interconnected. The more you big it up, the more disappointed you can be. And actually someone who is depressed, like so the goth who's sitting in their room late at night, they are depressed because, but not because they have given up hope, they still have too much hope. So for Nietzsche, they think there's something out there that will make them happy and they don't have it.
Have you seen John Mulaney's joke where he's like, maybe goth people are sad just because every morning they wake up and they remember to put all that shit back on. Like, oh, this again? The eyeliner? Ugh. Really funny.
That's good. Yeah. Well, no, it's that idea that if you're really depressed about something, if you're really depressed, that doesn't mean you've given up on life is beautiful. It means you're still caught up in it. Life is beautiful, but not for you.
Yeah.
And life is
beautiful. Life is beautiful, but not for them if they only saw things my way. Yeah.
So, but if you are able to, in one sense, turn hopelessness up to 11 and give up even hopelessness. So in one sense, it's like you've hopelessness and then utter despair. Yeah. But the utter despair is actually joy. So
were you sitting on hopelessness up to 11? Did you just pop that out, or did you have that in your pocket and you took it?
No, it was just that. It just came to me.
Yeah, you weren't like making your drink. You're like, I'm gonna say hopelessness. No, up to 11. That's really good, dude.
Was that good? I thought that was like two on the. You know, people always say that up to 11.
I know that's what's funny about it, because I never heard it with hopelessness. Because it's definitely a cheese. It's a cheese
cheesy thing, line. Yeah,
but yeah, like hope turn. The hopelessness up to 11 is really funny.
Yeah. And when you do that, the idea is that you're freed from both hope and hopelessness, because now, in a sense, what there is life. And you affirm it. It doesn't mean you have to enjoy all of your life. In fact, you can enjoy loads of it. But it means that you, in one sense, have found a way to see yourself as a part, a minor, tiny part of something that for a moment.
You know, I fancy myself a bit of an armchair philosopher, Peter. I like to, it's almost like a game. I was talking to a friend about people, and I was like, it's very fun to kind of like guess what people are going to do, you know, and sort of like guess people's psychologies. Like, I think I'm like in some alternate dimension. I was probably a psychologist, but in some iteration, some universe in the multiverse or whatever. But, I am going to now build upon Nietzsche, okay?
Right.
This is what you all do, right?
Yeah.
You take somebody's profound stuff and then you build on it?
Yeah.
Much like scientists? So I'm not wrong.
Yeah, we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Okay, so what if...
So I like the fact that you're gonna improve on Nietzsche.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not that we're not worried, like, let's be humble about it, but we're gonna improve.
Well, I'm gonna humbly improve upon Nietzsche. But I'm definitely gonna improve upon Nietzsche. So you have this, let's say you're like, okay, what he basically is espousing, it sounds like, according to what you're saying, is just call it like you see it. Like, be real, be honest, be like, it's neither good nor bad. That's all of life. It just is. You're here, and the delusions that, am I somewhere correct?
Pretty much is like he wanted to, I'm saying this for myself to make sure it's clear in my head, like he
didn't know if you just saw me butchering Nietzsche into so many pieces that you didn't know even put it back together.
I'm just worried if someone listens to me, I make sure I want to get my Nietzsche right. He is critical of Schopenhauer. He was very, he liked a lot, philosopher. He was the great pessimist. I mean, Schopenhauer is wonderful. He is, if you want a pessimistic philosopher, you read Schopenhauer. It's fun.
I'll write that down.
And Schopenhauer was incredible thinker. But then Nietzsche wanted to reject it because he felt that, again, as I say, there's something about, for him, nihilism that is connected to positivity, to meaning. And so, yeah, he wants to get beyond, he's a dialectic thinker, so he wants to get beyond both of those to, I suppose, embracing life as it is without letting it destroy you. So
you know, I mean, cute stuff, and I love what he was trying to do. All right, but try this on for size.
Okay, Pete, go for it.
What if there is a reality in which you can see reality as it is? All right, this has never been done. On the fundamentalists, we've never said new things.
No,
this has never been thought of.
Yes, this is great. I mean, get your notebooks out.
Yeah, it's weird that you're not literally on the edge of your seat. I can tell you are figuratively, but it's just I expected more. But so you can see reality as it is. There's reality, neither good nor bad, and you can attain, you can ascend, transcend the pessimism, optimism spectrum.
Yeah,
and see life truly as it is. What if?
Yeah, or he wouldn't. He probably wouldn't say we don't see life as it is, but we see life as we are. He would try to say. But anyway, yeah, keep going.
I mean, whatever. So something, So whatever the holes are in what he says, you can just fill them in. You know, I'm not going to get into the weeds with what he actually said or believed.
Of course not. I want to get to the meat.
I'm not going
to
get bothered.
I'm excited.
I'm not going to be bothered. I can't be bothered by what he said if I can spend my time talking about what I think he said. So here's what you do. You look at it in a real sense. Oh, congratulations. What a cool thing. We've transcended it. What a neat thing. What if you still just choose to look at it like it's nice? Like, boom. What if there's another layer? You can do what Nietzsche says. You see life as we are, right? To put it properly. And then on top of that, you go, I see it. And then it's a happier life when I just choose to be a little more positive.
Well, yes. And the only thing he would say is, and you're adding in like this other step. And he would say, no, you don't have to add in the other step, because the realization, the freedom from hope and hopelessness is what gets you to enjoy life. So he put it like this, psychoanalysis.
Yep, yep, I see what you're
saying. There is no psychosynthesis, because psychoanalysis is psychosynthesis. The more you analyze and take apart and get beyond the idea of some object that will satisfy you, see, the more you tear that apart, the happier you become. You don't have to then do a second step and go, oh, now I'm going to have a better view of life. As in one sense, when you're able to get beyond good and evil, or get beyond kind of Nietzsche's pessimism, optimism, you will have joy. Joy is a good name for it. That's what the Christian term is. It's not happiness, it's joy. Joy is
a perfect term for it. Yeah. Christianity nails the concept of joy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very technical concept, but because it's very different from happiness, but joy is in a sense what we're talking about. What Nietzsche's saying is that there is a way beyond the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness makes you more unhappy. That's the connection. You get beyond that and you can experience joy, which is in a sense a certain peace in the midst of the chaos of life.
Peace and joy. That's it. Yep. Yeah. It's beautiful stuff.
And he feels that so much morality, he called it slave morality, where he says so much of society is about bringing down, waking weak and making sick everything. So he had this big thing that he said that the weak don't need protected from the strong. He said the strong need protected from the weak, because there are very few people who have a fortitude, and society is always trying to pull you down. So he kind of goes, like, in one sense, he says, no, it's the strong who are in danger.
At what point, because if that's his theory, mm-hmm. and so I guess you're saying that the moment, I guess you're saying that what I pitched doesn't really work.
Well, no, I think you're saying the same things he's saying. He's just going that once you overcome hope and hopelessness, you will find a new type of hope, a new type of joy in life.
But what I pitched would be to say that if I basically, the counter would be, if you look at life the way it is and then you choose just to see it positively, Nietzsche would probably be like, well, if you're choosing to do it, you still clearly haven't truly given up the spectrum, because you're still opting in some way. So he's saying, yeah.
If by what you mean is like you're kind of like the willful illusion, in a sense, if you're talking about kind of the willful, then he would say, yeah, potentially you haven't experienced what he calls the death of God, which is the death of meaning, mm-hmm. the death of this kind of like notion of some ultimate good. I guess, you know, it depends. It's
you know, if they want people to like undergo that kind of thing so that they can come out the other side and experience this utopia, this joyful world that, you know, for lack of a better word, transcends this positive or pessimism, optimism spectrum. If they want to do that, they should come up with like maybe a sexier term than the death of God. Yeah. You know, psychoanalysis doesn't, and like all this stuff, nihilism doesn't sell itself very well.
Yeah. Well, I think I completely agree with you, except for the death of God. I thought it's like, that's quite a, I mean, maybe
it's
when
edgy.
You're a teenager, it's edgy. It's an edgy term.
When you're a teenager, it's like, death of God. You, I'm 31. I don't want to go undergo any deaths of gods. Yeah.
What would you, okay, let's remarket it. What are you thinking? If we're setting up a YouTube channel that we want to get a million subscribers over 5 years, say, and we want to sell this kind of like beyond nihilism thing.
Death of God.
Can't do that.
Death of God would be the most accurate term, I guess. Yeah. So it's difficult to come up with a term that's, you can't really package the death of God in like a,
you can't kind of go 12 steps to a more fulfilling life
to a deader
number,
God.
Number six will surprise you.
Number six steps will surprise you. Yeah. 9 easy steps to, I don't know. That's a very interesting thing. But so you go through this death of God.
Yeah.
And you attain this whatever. And then what? Yeah. That's when you end up like making out with horses when they're getting beat. Yeah. Like it didn't work for him, clearly.
Yeah, well, here, by the way, do you know who he was talking to when he talked about the death of God? This character.
Was it the horse? One last thing.
Yeah, you knew it was something. You were like, No, it was the people he didn't believe in God. He said that he was talking to secular people. He says, you do not know that God is dead and you have killed him. He wasn't talking to people who believed in God. Because what he was saying is...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was saying
that... Ooh, that's a good... That's one of those ones you can bust that one out at a party. Say that one more time. That's going to come in handy for people. This is for all those people who are listening who are like, I bet I can take some... say that again, because that's so good.
Yeah, well, he was saying, to a secular audience, the madman was talking to people who said they didn't believe in God. And he was saying, you have killed God... And you have no idea what you have done. He says, you have loosed the earth from its sun. You don't know where up or down or sideways is. You do not know the blood that is on your hands.
Just an audience of people being like, he's lost. He's out of his mind.
Well, that was totally it. The audience were like laughing at this madman. And the reason why, in a nutshell, is because he was saying that even though people give up the notion of God, they often retain the idea of a kind of like, a kind of a purpose and a meaning in life, and so they, he says, you have seen the lightning.
We've gone full Pete Rollins. The thing is, the problem is sometimes even after they don't believe in God, they still think that there's a meaning to be.
Yeah,
that's so funny. Yeah, it's just very like.
And he has a beautiful way. He says you've seen the lightning, but you haven't felt the thunder.
Yeah,
and then elsewhere he says in the Gay Science, he says after the Buddha died, it is said that the shadow of the Buddha was on a wall for millennia. He says, we must not simply get rid of God, but also the shadow of God.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all very impressive.
Beautifully put.
Beautifully put. And then, by the way, this is not anti-theology, because there's a whole movement in theology that says, this Nietzschean, and says, that what Nietzsche is attacking is this false notion of God that actually religion has always been trying to get rid of.
Yeah, so, that sounds like some heady stuff.
Yeah,
man.
Sorry, we did get heady there.
That's some fun. I mean, it's so fun, so fascinating. Gosh, talking to a bunch of people who don't believe in God and telling them that they do believe in God is fun. I guess we do that a lot on this podcast, so
yeah,
it all works out. Man, all right. So sickness. Did we cover everything
did
with
we
sickness?
Cover
I think we covered it top to bottom.
Well, at least that phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah, that's
only
really good.
If you're strong. And by the way, a bit of a critique of this, not that this was Nietzsche, but Nietzsche's sister, when he was mad, she took a lot of his notes, put them together, and this was really adopted by the Nazis. But Nietzsche was very anti that kind of movement in Germany. But he became like, because this whole thing about strength obviously feeds into a bit of a fascist kind of notion. So for a while, Nietzsche, although his work wasn't directly fascist, people felt that it had a fascist element. But it was largely to do with his sister and how she edited the notes together. But there still is this weird thing. I mean, Nietzsche did, he was nervous that society was getting sicker and sicker.
Yeah.
And he felt that, like, you know, we should affirm the achievements of society.
Yeah, because something about the argument of, oh, it was kind of his sister and the way she arranged the notes, something in that smells perhaps a little, I don't buy it.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
That sounds a little scapegoaty.
Yeah, you know? Well, she was a big Nazi. So was she, in fact, I wonder, did she know Hitler?
How much does it matter in arranging the notes? Like notes or the note, especially if he already writes kind of anecdotally and...
That is true. I mean, the book that she put together is called The Will to Power. And that some of the terminology, like will to power, was definitely adopted by kind of Nazi Party.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I've read that book. But she basically pulled together all of these fragments and bits and pieces. But I do think, like, Nietzsche was actually quite a conservative thinker, which is rare in philosophy. Philosophers tend towards the kind of the left. But people like Heidegger and Nietzsche and even Lacan tended towards the right, which is kind of, you know, so it's good that there's a little bit of a range there.
Yeah, that's nice.
But yeah, Nietzsche was more of a, he loved the Greeks, you know, he loved that strong kind of, you know, if you see 300, he wants the, you know, the Spartan, who was 300? That was was it the Spartans?
I don't know.
It was the Spartans. But, you know, that is a very tough warrior kind of race. And the whole point is they had to be. Otherwise, they'd be screwed. I mean, you can judge the Spartans for being kind of like, you know, killing off weak kids and stuff. But they lived in an age where if they hadn't been very tough, they would have been destroyed.
Going back to what Nietzsche said.
Yeah.
The strong need there.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, that, and Nietzsche would be that, sometimes you have to sacrifice everything, including your symbolic ideal. That's the, going back to the guy in the plane, mm-hmm. phoning, saying, I love you. It's like, sometimes, very occasionally, but we have to destroy everything, including having the strength to destroy our own reputation.
Wow.
And Nietzsche was a big fan of people who, like, and, you know, he was kind of that himself. He was a genius and walked away from university life and basically said, screw you, I don't care. I don't care what you think of me.
Wow.
Kind of like Kierkegaard. Him and Kierkegaard are very similar. And they both lived at the same time. They never met. Kierkegaard was the big Christian. Nietzsche was the big kind of antichrist, supposedly, he called himself. And their writings were very similar.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's some cool stuff right there. I love that. All right, do you have any takeaway? That was really good, man. That was good.
Is that right? I was worried that we got a bit lost in the weeds.
There's a little bit of weeds, you know? But that's just fun stuff, you know? Yeah. It's just educational.
Yes. Edutainment. That's what we're aiming at. Edutainment.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I learned stuff, which is
you
nice.
Learned about the horse?
I learned about the horse. Yes. Yeah, a little bit there. And the Nietzsche Kierkegaard thing is cool. And like, I don't know. I enjoy that type of stuff. I think we're always trying to find the perfect balance with this stuff. And then what will happen, folks, is where we'll stop recording in a second. We'll discuss how I felt about the episode. And we'll probably end up putting it up. But yeah, we do go back and forth on these conversations sometimes, but it's nice. It's a nice balance. Cause that's like, I'm not even sick enough to talk about really being sick.
Yeah. And I think I like what some of the things that I liked about what you were saying is I like the fact that you're saying that you can affirm life. You're enjoying your life in the midst of it being stressful. And, you know, it can be difficult financially to live somewhere like LA and my goodness, for the majority of the world, it's difficult to even find food. Mm-hmm. But, the stress of living in the US can be difficult. A lot of people find it hard to feed their families here, and it's difficult. You're doing a business, and yet you're able to, and you do, you affirm life.
Well,
and
thanks,
you say
man.
Yes to, you say
that.
Yes to life. That's a very Nietzschean thing, is to say yes.
I do feel like I say yes. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I enjoy it very much.
And that doesn't mean that's the big thing, not acknowledging the difficulties. Like Nietzsche was big in that, and I say he went mad in the end. But, but somehow, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
That's very nice. That's a beautiful sentiment. My takeaway would be, we were watching The Dark Knight the other night, and one of the first, I think it's the first line that the Joker says, where he's killing a guy and he takes off his mask, his clown mask, and it's his face, and he leans down and it's directly into the guy's face, and he says, I believe what doesn't kill you simply makes you stranger. And then he like smiles and then like rides off on the bus, and like the gas comes out and kills the guy. And I like that phrase more.
Yeah. Yes. That's good. And you know, and here the whole thing of the Joker, the whole role of the Joker is to try to show that beneath the civilized veneer of existence, it is chaos. Mm-hmm.
These people will eat each other. Yeah.
Which is a very interesting, like, you know, the Joker is, you know, closer to the truth in some way, and like he's trying to show something that
just the chaos,
the chaos that exists.
It's so good,
you know? We should do a good close reading of that movie someday.
And him doing that and being closer to the truth, and also the first line in the movie being a parody of Nietzsche's line and making it something that fits in with his sort of, it's, I think that's like the coolest thing.
And the funny thing is, like, in this, right, the Batman has only one rule, which is
don't kill people,
right. Now, I was thinking about this the other day, like, because the whole thing about Batman, as we know, is, right, he's doing this because his parents died, right? His parents were killed, so he dresses up as a bat, right, and goes out and beats people up. And, of course, I've talked about it before, other people have said it, it's like, it's hilarious, because what he could do, instead of spending the money on tanks, he could spend the money on after-schools programs.
I don't like her, right?
That would do more good. But here's the thing I was thinking about the other day, not that. I was thinking about how his only rule is not to kill, right? Which means exactly the thing is, he does not want to make Gotham better. He doesn't want to kill the baddies, because then he'd have to face his own suffering. So he has to keep them alive, because they keep breaking out of Arkham Asylum, right?
Right.
So then it repeats endlessly. So Batman basically needs the enemy, needs something bad to fight in order to avoid a confrontation with his own chaos.
Yeah.
And the last thing he wants is to actually clean up Gotham City. And I think the Joker is just trying to show him that.
Mm-hmm.
The Joker is just a good therapist. It's the one rule you're going to have to break.
Well, and that explains too why everybody loves Batman.
Yeah.
And everyone, we react to him as a society because mm-hmm. he is the representation of what we are as.
Yeah.
So now I feel like I'm bullshitting.
Yeah. But he is the one who is avoiding the chaos that is at the core of his life. I mean, the Batman is the one who will refuse to look at and deal with the chaos, you know, at the core of his life.
I feel like the thing that I've always loved about Batman is the fact that it's never seemed like good guy versus bad guy. It's always seemed like both these people are pretty messed up. Mm-hmm. And that I've thought that's like, I think on some level as a kid, that yeah. probably is what drew me in, because I'm such a Batman like fanatic, and I think maybe there's something there where it's like this guy always seems kind of off.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
even if like obviously like you can reinterpret the whole thing and you can do that, like, you know, up is down and all that, which is cool and I like it and I don't disagree with it, but like even just on the surface level, this is a guy who can't get over he's clearly not a healthy, mentally sound person. He's not yeah. processing tragedy the way that anybody should process it
until the end of the trilogy. And then when Bane dies, I don't think he kills Bane, but Bane dies and he confronts things and he's able to move on. So he finally is able to move on, but which is because he doesn't realize that he is creating mm-hmm. the villains he's fighting. Yeah, he's the only superhero that I kind of like. Mm. I gotta say,
oh yeah, he's my favorite. Anyway,
there you go.
Cool.
All right. we'll carry on outside the recording.
Yeah, we'll keep talking about Dark Knight. Bye, everybody.